a threefold cord. In the early 1580s, after 25 years on the throne, Elizabeth still dominated the Church of England. She was not its supreme governor in name only. Insisting on uniformity at every turn, she detested the Puritans, while hating the Anabaptists along with the newfangled separatists who were now beginning to form churches. The authorities had clamped down upon the Puritans, largely beating them into a grudging and sullen submission by this time, although the measures against them remained in force. Archbishop Whitgift compelled every minister of the state church to subscribe to the royal supremacy in all matters, to pledge unqualified assent to the 39 Articles, and to use only the Book of Common Prayer in worship. In 1584, a list of 24 questions on disputed points was presented to every Church of England minister to be answered on oath. In addition, to put a stop to all opposition, printing was forbidden unless licensed by the Star Chamber. But although the Puritans were emasculated, the Separatists proved more difficult to browbeat. The fact is, though worship outside the state system was entirely illegal, an increasing number were daring to do it. Responsibility for this could not be laid at Whitgift's door, for he was certainly zealous in the prosecution of his vigorous campaign, and the prisons rapidly filled with victims of all sorts. Some paid with their lives. Nevertheless, the rebels remained defiant. In such a time the world came to hear of Henry Barrow, John Greenwood, and John Penry. Barrow, a Norfolk man who was well connected by birth, graduated at Cambridge about the year 1570 to become a lawyer. At that time he was a drunken, debauched young man, a rank unbeliever. One day, however, when passing a London church, he caught sound of the preacher very loud in his discourse. His companion showed no interest in going in to hear a man talk, as he put it, but Barrow did, and was converted. By 1586 he belonged to a secret separatist group in London, about 100 strong, which was meeting in various places like houses along the river, Deptford Woods, or the gravel pits at Islington. It is probable that the group had developed out of the secret church of 1567-70, where Richard Fitz was pastor, although this company did not actually become a church until 1592. One John Greenwood was another member. Greenwood graduated at Cambridge about the year 1580, and was much influenced by the radical Puritan teaching there, the memory of Cartwright and Brown remaining very much alive. He became an Anglican minister, then a zealous Puritan chaplain in Essex, but remained deeply affected by the teaching of Brown. Moving to London, he associated with the Separatists, but he fell in with Barrow. The secret company of Separatists used to gather all day, each Lord's Day, for prayer and exposition of Scripture, starting at 5 in the morning. Any brother was at liberty to preach or pray, since the group rejected all Anglican notions of worship. There was a precious sense of charity among the members, especially when relieving the needs of any who were arrested and sent to prison. When in prison himself, and looking back in fond remembrance of those times, Barrow said, "So sweet is the harmony of God's graces unto me in the congregation, and the conversation of the saints at all times, as I think myself a sparrow on the housetop when I am exiled from them." Whitgift's spies were everywhere. Greenwood was seized reading the scriptures in a house on the 7th of October, 1586, and thrown into the clink. On hearing the grievous news, Barrow did not try to run away and hide, quite the opposite. He actually rode to the clink to visit his friend. But on the way he happened to discuss the New Testament teaching about the office of a bishop with a fellow traveller, who then betrayed him to the authorities. When Barrow arrived at the prison, they were waiting for him. He was allowed in, but not allowed out. After his arrest, the officials quickly sought the warrants necessary to legalize their unlawful actions. In his several trials, Barrow did not always conduct his defense wisely, using somewhat rough language on occasion. but it must be remembered the times were brutal. He may have used stern words. His enemies took sterner measures. Generally, in their trials, the separatists define their position with clarity and simplicity, conducting themselves with humility against the jeers of the tyrannical Star Chamber. But Barrow was blunt. In the extreme, some would say. But who can cast the first stone? Addressing Whitgift face to face, he dared to call him a beast and a monster. It was true enough, but he probably paid for his penetrating words with his life. The truth is, he was not out to save his skin. It was the thought of the terrible sufferings that men and women were enduring just because they wanted to worship God according to the New Testament, which always stirred him to the depths. Rightly, he would not stand on genteel ceremony with men who were responsible for the crushing of his brothers and sisters. He could write, in a moving appeal born of tortured helplessness, as he put it, that these enemies of God detain in their hands, within the prisons about London, about 70 persons, men, women, young and old, lying in cold, in hunger, in dungeons and in irons. He had no time or wish to bandy fine words with the enemies of God. If 72 separatist prisoners were locked away in London, it can only be wondered how many of them languished in jails in the rest of the country. The main accusations against Barrow were that he had dared to say that the parish system of the Church of England, in which no distinction is made between believers and unbelievers, means that such assemblies are not true churches, that no prince can make laws for the church other than Christ allows in his word, that the worship of the Church of England is idolatrous, that his ministry is anti-Christian, that the church must reform immediately without waiting for the prince, and that any transgressor is to be excommunicated, including the Queen herself if necessary. There must be no respect of persons. Greenwood, in his trial, declared that Christ is the only head of his church, and his laws cannot be altered by any man. Statements like these put both men on a direct road to the gallows. Barrow and Greenwood maintained that the only right and proper course for those who believe that the state church is unscriptural is to separate from it. It is wrong of men and dishonourable of them to continue in a system which they do not believe in, and to accept payment from that system, and to teach its doctrines and practices. These statements, of course, made uncomfortable reading for a great many, especially the Puritans who were guilty of the very things Barrow and Greenwood denounced. The Puritans did continue in the state church, and were paid for it, even though they knew the church was corrupt. These were serious assertions. They are relevant today. It is always wrong and dishonourable for men to be part of a corrupt church system which they do not believe in, and to be maintained by that system for teaching and upholding practices and doctrines they know to be questionable or even false. But it is done, and not only in the state church. Whenever men stifle conscience and act against it in order to keep their position, and for whatever reason, it is wrong. Doing a little evil to accomplish much good is not a Christian principle. The laws which have been framed against the papists were now invoked with vigour against the separatists. Because Barrow and Greenwood refused to conform to the Church of England and attend some church chapel or usual place of common prayer, they were confined in the Fleet, the torture chambers of which were the most terrible in London. From their dungeon they sent the Queen a lamentable petition on the 13th of March, 1588, on behalf of the miserable prisoners. Some were in cold and foul cells, others bound hand and foot with bolts and fetters of iron, they said. One man had died of jail fever in prison, aged 66. Another had been dragged from his wife and 8 children, and subsequently died in prison. 2 aged widows died of jail disease. The offence common to all? They had listened to Greenwood preaching. Would you be prepared to suffer in order that you could worship in a church where you did not have to use set prayers? What price would you pay so that you could be in a church which was composed only of the regenerate? Are you willing to put yourself out in order to meet with the church to hear scriptural preaching from powerful ministers? Do you value these things enough to pay a high price for them? Barrow and Greenwood did not give way under their torments. What an understatement. Nor did they gripe. Taking the fight for the recovery of the New Testament church to their enemies, during their time in prison they published a massive amount of literature. How they did it is almost too much to grasp. Think of their courage. A sentence of death hung over those engaged in this kind of work by reason of the Star Chamber decree. Furthermore, how could they see to write in the pitch-black darkness? And where did they get writing materials? There was no peace and quiet in the crowded, foul dungeons, no books to consult. How did they smuggle their works out of prison? But right they did. And how? Some of the titles and subjects of their books make interesting reading in themselves. A brief summary of the causes of our separation. A true description of the visible congregation of the saints. The separatists mistakenly continued to use the idea of visible churches. See my infant baptism tested. A treatise against red prayers. A treatise against the criticism which linked the separatists to the Donatists, members of a protest movement in the 4th century churches of North Africa. A summary of certain conferences in the Fleet. A volume calling upon the Queen to root out apostate ministers. A brief discovery of the false church. The last mentioned volume was not as brief as all that, since it was nearly 400 pages long, and 3,000 copies were printed. The list on its own shows that Barrow and Greenwood were men of the highest caliber. During 1589-90, 42 Anglican ministers were appointed to confer with the separatist prisoners. The preachers chosen by the authorities for this task were mainly Episcopalian Puritans. In truth, the conferences were a sham, since their real purpose was to discover the whereabouts of the secret meetings. But the underhand scheme failed utterly. Barrow did not buckle in the face of stern opposition, but continued his resolute fight to get the church back to the New Testament. He alleged that it is the immediate duty of the godly to separate from a corrupt church, in this case the Church of England. The parishes are no true church. That without proper spiritual discipline there can be no church, no ministry, and no Lord's Supper. That the Scriptures are the sole and complete guide and rule in the church. That no man can alter the least part of the Bible. That a particular church is a company of faithful and holy people gathered in the name of Christ, governed by his laws and officers. He had a biblical view of the church. He roundly declared, "Most joyful, excellent, and glorious things are everywhere in the Scriptures spoken of this church. It is called the city, house, temple, and mountain of the eternal God, the chosen generation, the holy nation, the peculiar people, the vineyard, the garden enclosed, the heritage, the kingdom of Christ, yea, his love, his spouse, his queen, and his body, the joy of the whole earth. To this society is the covenant and all the promises made of peace, of love, and of salvation, and the presence of God, of his graces, of his power, and of his protection." Barrow opposed Presbyterianism, holding to the same church officers as Brown had done a few years before him. Nevertheless, he was somewhat confused as to the actual exercise of power in a local church. Sometimes, it seems, he felt the officers were the practical authority, at other times he seemed to come to a congregational view, where the members ruled the church through the church meeting. This question of the rule of a church would prove a thorny issue among the separatists within a few years. Barrow believed that only the pastor could administer the ordinances of baptism and the Lord's Supper. Consequently, if the pastor was in prison, the church would have to go for months without the supper. The pastor must be supported financially, he claimed, but only by the monetary gifts of the believers. While it's not certain, it is possible that he was beginning to question the practice of the baptism of infants. Should it be for believers only? There is some evidence that he was thinking along these lines. Barrow was allowed to rot in the Fleet until 1593, kept by the prelates in the most miserable and strict imprisonment. He pitifully pleaded for the release of our poor, worn bodies out of this miserable jail. But it brought little response. The less fiery Greenwood was released for a little while in 1592. Yet despite all the hostility they met with, the members of the London group even now did not play safe. They formed themselves into a church in 1592, at the very height of their troubles, with one Francis Johnson as pastor. It became known as the Ancient Church. Barrow and Greenwood were finally charged and sentenced to death under one of Elizabeth's statutes against the publishing of unauthorized books. On several occasions they were about to be executed, but were reprieved at the last minute, once with the ropes actually tied around their necks. What harrowing experiences! But eventually, on the 6th of April, 1593, the abominable sentence was carried out, and the two separatists were hanged at Tyburn. It is reported that just after their death, the Queen asked a learned adviser what he thought of the two men. If they had lived, they would have been two as worthy instruments for the Church of God as have been raised up in this age, he replied. She asked another what end they made. A very godly end, and prayed for your majesty and the state, she was told. Meanwhile, what of the third element of the threefold cord, John Penry? He too was executed, hanged on the 29th of May, 1593. Penry was born in 1559 in the mountains of Wales. He went to Cambridge and thence to Oxford, where Puritan influence was instrumental in converting him from his zealous Romanism. At one time he was so eager a papist he would break out of his rooms to go to midnight mass. After his conversion, greatly sensing the joy of his salvation, Penry grieved over the state of the thousands of his fellow Welshmen who never heard of Christ, who were given up to idolatry, swearing, adultery, theft, and superstition. He was appalled that the Anglican priests were ignorant, drunken, and debauched. He knew that the people of Wales were practically destitute of preaching, the bishops being too much taken up with the suppression of Puritans and separatists in England to bother about the spiritual welfare of the principality. Penry did what he could to take the gospel to his homeland, single-handed. He travelled widely throughout Wales, preaching in the open air without official position or recognition. It was reported of him that he was an edifying preacher and a good man, esteemed by many, with more than ordinary learning in him. He was known as a most gifted minister, godly, full of love and compassion for souls, learned and sympathetic, devoted to the service of the gospel. He was a very effective preacher. Sinners were converted, and saints were edified under his ministry, not only in Wales, but in England and Scotland too. Naturally, this sort of preaching aroused a decadent, drunken, and negligent clergy, who fought back in anger. Their jealousy expressed itself in a bitter hatred of him, whereupon he appealed to the Queen and Parliament in a treatise he published in 1587. This in itself was illegal, and made him a marked man. In his book he pleaded that preaching might be set up in Wales, that some ordering might be taken for the preaching of the gospel among the people. At this stage he was a loyal Episcopalian, and submissive to the Queen, clearly holding to the concept of a state church, to be ruled and funded by Parliament. He was no separatist, but a decided and faithful son of the established church. He even dedicated the work to my fathers and brethren of the Church of England. All he asked was that Welsh preachers should be sent to preach Christ to the Welsh in their own language. Non-resident ministers and those who merely read the homilies should be got rid of. The crying, desperate need was for living preachers, living in more sense than one. As for money to support them, he declared that they whose hearts the Lord has touched would thresh to get their living, rather than the people should want preaching. Our gentlemen and people, if they knew the good that ensues from preaching, would be soon brought to contribute. But this kind of publication was against the law. It was a violation of the Star Chamber decree. For this offence, Penry was roughly handled, thrown into prison for a month, and then tried. The charge brought against him was that he said that ministers who never preach are no true ministers. He did not draw back. I thank God that I ever knew such a heresy, as I will, by the grace of God, sooner leave my life than leave it. That is the heresy, he declared. Whitgift retorted that he would make him recant. Never, God willing, so long as I live, came the staunch reply. He would prove the worth of his words. Yet, amazingly, he was released, but continued to face persecution. Even now he would not take the easy way out, but showed immense courage and devotion to Christ. He wrote that he could not, he would not give up the fight. Rather, he said, if I perish, I perish. If I might live upon this earth the days of Methuselah, twice told, and that in no less comfort than Peter, James, and John were in the mount, and after this life might be sure of the kingdom of heaven, yet to gain all this, I dare not go from the former testimony to the truth of Jesus Christ. If my blood were an ocean sea, and every drop thereof were a life to me, I would give them all by the help of the Lord for the maintenance of the same, my confession. He went to Scotland, where he was well received on account of his Puritan principles, and he was allowed to preach freely. In September 1592, Penry's thoughts once again turned homewards to Wales, and he returned to London in order to petition the Queen that he might be allowed to preach in his own land. This was a highly dangerous move. Whitgift had a warrant out for his arrest, and Elizabeth had written personally to James of Scotland to have Penry apprehended. To add to the risk, Penry now showed that his continued study of the New Testament had brought him to the separatist position. He had joined the newly formed London Church, the Ancient Church, where he fell in with Barrow and Greenwood, men whom he called my dear brethren. This was a step fraught with danger. Nevertheless, he did not flinch. He was appointed to preach in the church, and was recognized by the vicar of Stepney, betrayed to the authorities, and imprisoned. During his trial, he heard that his friends Barrow and Greenwood had been hanged, and he knew that he now had no hope of escape. He made one final pathetic appeal in which he stated, I am a poor young man, born and bred in the mountains of Wales. I am the first, since the last springing up of the gospel in this latter age, that laboured to have the blessed seed thereof sown in these barren mountains. If my death can procure any quietness unto the Church of God, and unto the state of my prince, and his kingdom wherein I was born, glad I am that I had a life to bestow in this service. On the day his friends were executed, Penry wrote to his wife, whom he had married less than 5 years before. When we recall that it was an age when there was nothing like social security, widows or child benefit to fall back on, and she had 4 little girls to bring up on her own, his words are most moving. He faced death squarely. He addressed his letter to my beloved wife, Helena Penry, partaker with me in this life of the sufferings of the gospel of the kingdom and patience of Jesus Christ, and resting with me in undoubted hope of that glory which shall be revealed. So dear a sister, and so loving a wife in the Lord, I know, my good Helen, that the burden which I lay upon thee of 4 infants, whereof the eldest is not yet 4 years old, will not seem in any way burdensome unto thee. Yea, thou shalt find that our God will be a father to the fatherless, and a stay unto the widow. I am ready. Pray for me. The Lord comfort thee, good Helen, and strengthen thee. My God will provide. My love be with thee now and ever in Jesus Christ, in great haste, with many tears, and yet in great spiritual comfort of my soul, your husband for a season, and your brother for evermore. 4 days later he wrote to his 4 dear and tenderly beloved daughters, to be read when they come to years of discretion and understanding. I have left you 4 Bibles, he said, being the sole and only patrimony and dowry that I have for you. since he had commenced the letter wishing them deliverance, comfort, safety, and sure hope, and we know that the eldest was called Deliverance. Perhaps we are here given all four names. Last of all, he wrote to the church, the distressed and faithful congregation of Christ in London. Seeing banishment with loss of goods is likely to betide you all, prepare yourselves for this hard entreaty, he told them. He advised them to leave England, and in so doing remember to cleave together. Be all of you assured that he, who is your God in England, will be your God in any other land under the whole heaven. For the earth and the fullness thereof are his, and blessed are they that for his cause are bereaved of any part of the same. He pleaded with the church to take into exile his poor and desolate widow, along with his fatherless and friendless orphans. The Lord, my brethren and sisters, hath not forgotten to be gracious unto Zion. You shall yet find days of peace and rest if you continue faithful. As John Penry sat at his midday meal on the 29th of May, 1593, he was informed that he had but 4 hours to live. That same afternoon, forbidden to utter any last words, he was hanged in secret at St. Thomas of Watering, Southwark, on the baseless charge of treason. He was little more than 30 years old. Any words of mine must be superfluous, an insult to the memory of such godly men as these three. I leave you to ponder their testimony. Who can be unmoved? It is appropriate to quote the words of Paul, commenting on his own sufferings for Christ. But I want you to know, brethren, that the things which happened to me have actually turned out for the furtherance of the gospel, so it has become evident to the whole palace guard and to all the rest that my chains are in Christ. And most of the brethren in the Lord, having become confident by my chains, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. I am appointed for the defence of the gospel. What then? Christ is preached, and in this I rejoice, yes, and will rejoice. May the retelling of the sufferings of Barrow, Greenwood, and Penry produce a similar furtherance of the gospel in our day. In 1593, Elizabeth and her bishop seemed all-conquering. They had defeated the Puritans in general, and the Presbyterians in particular, cowing them into an unwilling submission. With the execution of Barrow, Greenwood, and Penry, the separatists, too, were at a very low ebb. It is true that Sir Walter Raleigh reported that there were nearly 30,000 of them at the time, but this was a wild exaggeration. Probably there were no more than 500 or 600. The stark fact is their leaders had been hanged or had died in dungeons. Their surviving pastors, teachers, and most able members were in prison. As one bitter critic of the separatists put it, it appeared that they were at the most a very small number, a very silly and base people, here and there in corners dispersed. Now, thanks be to God, by the good remedies that have been used, suppressed and worn out, so that there is scarce any news of them. Separatism was about to die, even in its infancy. Or was it?